Hi friends, welcome back to another episode of Colts, Killers, and Cocktails with Jen and Vanessa.
Please be advised, the following episode is for mature audiences only. We talk about content that may be triggering to some individuals and contain discussions regarding rape, murder, sex, suicide, religious organizations, and disturbing situations.
Now, let's get into this week's episode. Hey guys, welcome back to another episode
of Colts, Killers, and Cocktails.
And we did not take as long of a break this time.
And we're not going to in the future.
Because we're doing better this summer.
That's right.
But we actually did have an excuse this time. I got the Rona. So
we had to put things on hold.
Had to quarantine technically 5 days, but I did 10 just to make sure that no longer contagious. But we're back in action and we're ready to kick it off.
Yeah, and right before the 4th of July weekend, so that's very exciting.
It is. Going to the lake, going to watch some fireworks. It's going to be a good time.
I'm going to go to a baseball game, eat a hot dog, drink a beer, and celebrate America.
You got to get ice cream, too.
You know what? I didn't even think about that. That's a great idea.
Yeah, you got to do that. But, all right.
Okay, so, have you ever heard of the Matamoros cult?
No, but it sounds like it's English. Is it? Like, from England.
It's not. So, have you ever heard of Adolfo Jesus Constanzo?
Negative.
Okay. Otherwise known as the Godfather.
Oh, my God. I'm so stupid.
Not like the Godfather of the TV show. This is something completely different. Like, Godfather true crime version.
No, but I want to.
Okay. Awesome. So, let's start all the way from the very beginning. So, Adolfo de Jesus Constanzo, which for the rest of this episode, I'm just going to reference him as Adolfo.
Please do.
Thank you. he was born on November 1st, 1962. He was born in Miami, and his mother's name was Della Aurora Gonzalez, and she was a Cuban immigrant that came over in 1962. She was fleeing the revolution. So, she had him at 15 years old.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And his father passed away when he was an infant, but later down the road, she had two different children from different fathers, like, later in time.
So was he, like, was one of the later fathers kind of like a stepfather to him?
Mm-hmm. Or okay, yeah, he had multiple stepfathers. So at 6 months old, she had him blessed by a Palo Mayombo priest. And we'll get into what Palo Mayombo means later in this episode. But when he was blessed by this priest at 6 months old, the priest was like, "This is the chosen one, and he is destined for great power." And she believed it.
Oh.
So his mom was a priestess in Santeria, and they're kind of the same as Palo Mayombo when it comes to the religions, but they just differ in a couple different ways. Santeria is more about, like, good fortune, protecting your family. Palo Mayombo is more about, like, power. And so we'll get into that later.
Okay.
So after the biological father died, she moved to San Juan, Puerto Rico, and that's where she found her next husband. Adolfo, at the time, was baptized in the Catholic Church because it was his father's wishes, and even served as an altar boy when he was very, very young. But his mom took him on secret trips to Haiti, where he learned about voodoo and practiced it in secret with his mother. Locals said that, again, she was the priestess of the Santeria religion, which when I was thinking about that, I'm like, I really have never heard of Santeria. And then I thought of the song that I don't practice Santeria.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, right?
Oh, man. I would have never even thought of that. Good catch.
Yeah. So she took him on all these trips to Haiti. And a lot of people say that Haiti is 90% Catholic and 100% voodoo.
Fun fact, I did not know that.
Yeah, so if that tells you anything, pretty much everybody practices voodoo there, but a lot of people have Christian ties as well.
Okay.
This Palo Mayombo blends Catholicism, Western, and Central African spirituality. A lot of the people in the Haitian culture, voodoo revolves around spirits, like saints in Catholicism. They serve the deity Bondi. And in Haiti, a lot of voodooists usually meet in, like, a temple, which they called an Iwa, like I-W-A is how it's spelled. And it's ran by the priest or the priestess. And the practitioners are like drumming, singing, and dancing to encourage the deity to possess one of their members and that way communicate with them. Offerings usually include fruit, liquor, and sacrificed animals.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Yeah. So just as a reference, if anyone else is very squeamish about sacrificing animals, you might want to skip into the episode to later to when Vanessa speaks, because that's going to be a central theme throughout this.
Okay. So I'm pushing the skip button right now. Can I? It's not working.
Right. So they usually do those type of offerings. And they're also given to spirits of the dead. Several forms of divination are utilized to decipher messages from the deity. There's a lot of healing rituals and preparation of like herbal remedies and talismans that play a prominent role in like Haitian culture.
So is this like,
so this is what he's being experienced to.
Okay.
When he's like a kid, because his mom is taking him all these secret trips to Haiti. This is everything that he's experiencing.
Okay. Well, I just remember from like me going to New Orleans, there's voodoo and hoodoo. And which one was the bad one? Was it voodoo or was it hoodoo?
I'm not sure.
Okay. Maybe cut that out then. But I don't know.
I've never heard of hoodoo.
Okay.
But we'll have to look into that actually at some point. Because that'd be a really good thing to do.
Yeah.
In 1972, the family returned to Miami and stepfather number one died of cancer in 1973, and the family received money from that, from like life insurance policies and so forth. At age 10, he started being an apprentice under a priest that practiced Palo Mayombe in Little Havana. And this is where we get into what Palo Mayombe is and how it's different. So it's the darker side of Santeria, because again, Santeria focuses on family, protecting family, and like being good. Just as a preface, Palo Mayombe is not always a bad thing, but in this type of situation, he used it the bad side of Palo Mayombe. So Palo Mayombe is an African religion that developed in Cuba. It allows practitioners to choose either a good or a bad path without moral judgment. So if it's a magic religion, they practice magic, but they don't think there's anything that's like bad magic. So if you compare it to Hogwarts, it's not Slytherin.
Gotcha.
Everyone can be in Gryffindor.
Okay.
Paulo teaches the existence that there's a creator who doesn't really have anything to do with humans in our day-to-day lives. The main thing that the creator does is he has a bunch of deities. So there's tons of gods in Palo Mayombe. And one of the vessels that Palo Mayombe uses in order to practice is called like a nanga. Or a vessel is another way to put it. And pretty much it's this iron cauldron. And it's usually wrapped in a ton of chains. And that's what they use to like cast spells and really practice everything.
What do they put in there?
That's a great question. So you can put in your animal sacrifices.
Oh, no.
If you want to. They believe that there has to be some type of sacrifice in this nanga. You can also put in... You also have to at least put in the sacred branches of 28 branches. So they have to have wood in there. And then they usually put in blood as well from the sacrifices too.
So like they just cut themselves and they just sprinkle their blood?
Or the blood from the animals, you know. Okay. The thing that's really interesting about it is a ton of people actually grave rob in order to put human body parts in there, like bones.
Oh, they're Ed Geins.
Yeah, nice. They are Ed Geins. Yeah. Because they thought they would get more power that way. People thought that if you put in, like, you know, someone's brain, for instance, you'd be able to create their, you'd be able to channel their spirit and then make the spirit do your will.
I mean, that would make sense if you believed in that. Yeah. I mean, that would be the organ that I would go with.
Yeah. So other things they added into it too were shells, plants, gemstones, coins, razor blades, knives, padlocks. Again, blood is essential pretty much. Wax, liquor, wine, quicksilver, and spices. And as you can imagine, this attracts a lot of insects because it smells pretty, pretty bad. And they would think that the worse it smells, like the better it's working type deal.
Ooh.
Because you're smelling all of that decay.
Yeah. Sounds like a bad Powerpuff Girls recipe.
Right. So specifically for most of the spells... Animal parts were added to enhance the skills in the Nanga. For example, a bat skeleton might give someone the ability to fly through the night to like conduct errands like safely, things like that nature. Again, we said that if they used a dead person's body part, they would inhabit it and become the slave of the Naga, so they could do whatever the person's will was. They would usually keep these vessels or the Nagas in separate rooms from other parts of their house because, again, the smell was pretty crazy. And they would keep having to add things into the vessel. So if you added it in blood for the animals, you have to keep adding in blood because it starts craving blood. So it's more like a living thing is how people think of it.
So it's kind of like a Demogorgon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, kind of. You're referencing Stranger Things. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's the thing about Palomayombo. One thing to know is that in most instances for Palomayombo, a lot of people only do animal sacrifices. Now, the person that this guy was learning from said, oh, yeah, animal sacrifices are great. But if you really want to get the job done, you need to do human sacrifices.
How did I know that was coming?
Right. So that's how Adolfo was influenced incorrectly, even at the beginning. If you talk to anyone that's in Palomayombo, they usually state that they never do human sacrifices. And they believe as well that if you're homosexual, your curses or your spells will not go through because the ancestors do not like it because everything's tied to ancestry. Everything is tied to ancestry.
Literally has nothing to do with it. Your sexual preference has nothing to do with
that's it. That's just a belief that is still held today.
Oh my God.
So let's go back to the mom. So the mom, after the dad dies of cancer, remarries. The newest stepfather was actually involved in Palomayombo. And he was also a drug dealer.
Of course he was.
Yeah. So at 10 years old, Adolfo starts getting training from the priest in Palomayombo. And again, like we said earlier, the priest believed in a couple different things than the main religion. Again, he believed in murder of people for power. He said that if anyone didn't believe in Palomayombo, they're pretty much an animal. So you can sacrifice them anyways. Also, if they die in torment or if they're dying in pain, it's going to be a better sacrifice for you.
So the more pain, the
better sacrifice.
Oh my gosh.
So Adolfo was even quoted later, like, they better die screaming.
Oh, that's gut-wrenching.
Yeah. So again, he's 10 years old. While the priest is training him on all these spells, rituals, and everything, he also starts molesting him.
Why?
Yeah, so Adolfo is subjected to that at a young age.
Okay, so he's been through some trauma.
He has been through trauma. Him and his mom, actually, were arrested for theft, vandalism, shoplifting. And in his teens, he started frequenting gay bars, which, again, is a big no-no in Palo Alto. Because he's gay, it's not going to come true.
Right.
In Miami, a lot of his mother's neighbors didn't like her. And this was because if they had a disagreement or argument, she would literally find some type of bird, cut its head off, wrap the head in like a red cloth, and have the body, and she'd leave it on their front doorstep.
Talk about passive aggressive.
Right.
Like, I've heard like kids like leaving dog shit on your doorstep, but I mean, that just takes it to another level.
Yeah. If she was my neighbor, I'd be like, what can I do for you today? Do you like flowers? I'll get you flowers. What do you want?
Do you
want
to split this pizza I just ordered?
Yeah.
Or actually, you can get your own pizza.
Yeah. What do you want? I'll buy it for you. Yeah. It's fine. I just don't want a dead bird on my doorstep.
Oh my gosh.
And actually, later in her life, she was arrested for having 27 animals in her apartment at one time. Because she just kept animals in her apartment when she would have them at her free will so she could sacrifice them.
Those poor babies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And when Adolfo was being a good boy or, you know, did something great, she would reward him actually by giving an animal to be sacrificed. So that was his reward.
And he would be, he'd be okay with that.
You know, like, think about it. He's like, oh, this is great. I get to sacrifice something.
Oh.
At 13 years old, he was said to be astral projecting out of his body, which if anyone has watched Sabrina the Teenage Witch, you can see that there. But it's when people think that you're leaving your body and you can go travel to find out different things. So they were like, he's astral projecting because there's no way he would know certain things. He was also able to read minds at 13 years old because, again, he's training, right?
You know, this is totally random, but when I was a hostess at a restaurant, when I was 16 years old or 17 years old, some woman came up to me and was like, yeah, my son can levitate. And I was like, ma'am, I just asked how many were in your party. And like, she tried to show me him levitating and he just sat there.
Was he
like,
levitating?
No, he didn't levitate. And she was like, he's shy. And I was like, I feel like this might be a cult. I mean, 16-year-old Vanessa did not know that, but.
Right. But that's very weird.
Yeah. So, okay. Continue.
Okay. So again, the priest kept continuing to teach him to practice palomayombo. But he was also teaching him how to really use this to like profit like people like drug dealers and con artists. Let's fast forward for when he's 21. At 21 years old, he pledged himself to Palo Alto, like totally went into it. He had to do a ceremony where he had to sleep under a tree for 7 nights. He had to bathe in herbs, and then he had to wear clothes that had been buried for 3 weeks.
What is the significance of that? Is
it was
just any
part of the ritual? Okay. So after that, they decided to go through the ritual. He pledged himself to one of the deities, which the deity that he chose is like the modern day devil and like Catholicism, Christianity, all of that. So that's what he pledged himself to, which ironically, his teacher also pledged himself to the same deity. And after that, he said his soul is dead and he has no God.
But he just pledged himself
to the devil, not a god.
Oh. Okay. Well, actually, the devil was an angel.
That is true.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So after that, 1983, he moved to Mexico and supported himself by doing tarot card readings and modeling.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So he's actually a looker. We'll post his picture on the Instagram. But okay. He was very cute. He read people's futures. He would give wealthy drug dealers like predictions of like, you should travel at this time in order to make your drop off safely, you know, and things of that. And he would free them from curses. So, you know, he's doing pretty well. He's having his own little side business. He said he actually moved to Mexico City he actually moved to Mexico because the USA was not that into magic. So obviously that was before Harry Potter came out.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, bitches love magic now.
Now I feel like people would be like, vampires are magic? Okay, sign me up.
Sign me up, for real.
Yeah. So he would give them magic to, like, make them bulletproof, invisible during their drop-offs, and things of that nature. And people actually like, worshipped him, and they thought he was the real deal.
Did any of these, like, superpowers work for them? If
they're planning out their drug deal and it goes fine, but he gave them a protection spell, they're going to be like, yeah, this guy's pretty awesome.
Yeah. You know? I didn't die. Oh, my invisibility worked.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. So he's starting to get a really big following. He is recruiting male recruits by meeting them out at night. They're falling in love with him and, you know, they decide to start believing in his religion. And he's doing it with the female followers, too. And they called him El Padrino, the Godfather.
Okay.
So next week, we're going to talk about when he starts getting these recruits, what he's doing with them, and how that transfers into sacrificing human sacrifices for drug dealers.
You're leaving us hanging.
I know.
But you're the two-parter this time. That was really good, though. And yeah. I'm very excited to hear the second part. And we're not recording 2 episodes in one day, so I have to wait in suspense like the rest of you.
Yep. Ugh. We'll see you in a week.
Okay. Well, good job. That was good.
Yeah. So that's the religion of Palo Alto.
I like it.
Not a cult, but this guy turns it into a cult. And like I said before, Palo Alto can be a religion that is practiced safely, you know, if you don't go into the human sacrifice region.
Yeah. If you pick the angel side of your shoulder versus right. The devil side of your shoulder. Gotcha. All right. Well, you want to get into this cocktail this week?
Let's do it. I'm drinking it now and I like it.
Yeah. So this is called the Firecracker.
It reminds me of that scene in Legally Blonde where she's like, you look like the 4th of July.
Oh, it's such a 4th of July vibe. So the first thing you're going to do is you're going to add a little bit of grenadine at the bottom. And then in a separate shaker, you're going to add vodka, Tito's, because it's the best, and then lemonade. And then on the top, you'll sprinkle some blue curacao on top. And if you do it right, if you layer it right, it'll come out red, white, and blue. So it's pretty delicious.
I like it.
I'm digging it. All right. Are you ready?
Let's
for my
do
episode?
It.
So I'm going to start off this episode with a fun fact. Our podcast is 21 episodes old.
Aw, I feel like we need to go out and have like a 21st birthday party.
I know. Like, we need to take a shot. No, we don't need to take a shot.
We don't need to. It's a Thursday night. It's a Tuesday night.
God, we don't even know what day it is.
Feels like a Thursday.
Oh my gosh. No, it's Wednesday.
It's a Wednesday.
It's Wednesday. We don't know what day it is. It's Stranger Things. We're in the Upside Down. So sorry. But our podcast is officially drinking age. So, you know, covering all these serial killer stories, I've been reading a lot of books to get you guys like a lot more detail. And so I can tell you guys a little bit more about the story. But I did not have time to read a book this time. And so we're going to kind of shift a little bit and we're going to be covering a mass murder today.
Which one?
Have you ever heard of the Kandahar massacre?
No.
Okay. Buckle up because it's going to piss you off.
I'm ready.
Okay. It's going to make you mad. So we are going to travel to Afghanistan and we are going to hop in our little time machine and go back to 2012, aka the year that the world was supposed to end.
Mm-hmm.
So this is just a not so fun fact. We started college in like 2010, right?
We sure did.
We sure did. We're aging ourselves. So I had a really good friend from high school and he legitimately thought the world was going to end in 2012.
Oh,
and so he was taking out all of these student loans, like the max amount.
No.
Every single time.
Oh God.
And then the world didn't end. And I was like, what are you going to do, buddy? And I don't know what he's doing to this day.
I was about to
them.
Say, we need to find this man.
We need an update. Like, please, please give us your update. Yeah, he is probably in a lot of student loan debt right now. But anyways, it's the early morning hours of March 11th. And we're talking like early, like 1:15 in the morning. The village of Alakozai, Afghanistan is sound asleep. And this could be described as a poor village. Like the houses are made out of mud. There are rooms in the house, but there are no doors, there's no electricity, there's no plumbing. It's basically just like a shelter from the rain. Because it is a poor village, multiple people occupied a single house. And it wasn't just like a family of four. It was like maybe like one or two dozen people. This included village elder Syed Jan. He lived with his wife, Na Kamarga, his two grandchildren, his cousin, Kudai, Kudai's wife, and Kudai's personal seven children, making 13 people that totaled the home. Again, this is around 1 a.m., so everybody has passed out. All of a sudden, they are woken up to someone screaming at them in a language that they don't understand. This man is dressed in a green shirt, camo pants, boots, gloves, and a combat helmet with night vision goggles. It's clear that he's not a villager, and whatever he was yelling, he was angry, very angry. He forces everyone into the main room. He's still screaming. Nikamarga was so scared that she would do anything to get out of that situation. So she had kind of like a fight or flight response, and she decides to flight. She decides to get the fuck out of there. She grabs her two grandchildren, and they make a run for the exit. The intruder sees this, but he wants to make sure everyone actually listened to him and gathered into the main room because he's trying to like gather everybody up. He finds Kudai in one of the bedrooms, and he was mad that he didn't go into the main room when he commanded, and he shoots him several times, and he's dead.
Okay.
Then he runs after Nikamarga. The family dog runs after the gunman, to which he shoots the dog point blank and kills him. And he would later say in an interview, "You need to understand, Fido wasn't a family pet. Fido was there to warn that somebody was coming."
If it's a dog in a house, it's a family pet.
Exactly. And the thing is, every dog is going to run. If your owner is running and screaming, every dog is going to attack. So now, I mean, the village is hearing all this commotion. Multiple people are going outside to see what the hell is going on. And this brave soul named Nazir Muhammad goes up to the gunman, and he's just like trying to calm him down, trying to understand what he wants. Why is he shooting the villagers? The gunman immediately starts beating the living pulp out of this poor man and starts yelling, "Where are the Taliban? Where are they?" His wife and 3-year-old daughter are hysterically crying, pleading with this man to stop. This makes the gunman angrier, and he shoots and kills Nazir. People are running and screaming at this point. And they're screaming, "The American is shooting people, hide." He was shooting anyone who got in his way. It didn't matter if it was a man, a woman, a child, anyone. This man was on a full rampage. So there is another victim named Muhaid Naeem. He was shot in the face and neck. Since this was a pretty small village, there were no real places to hide, and so he found everyone pretty quickly. And he finally found Nikamarga, and he immediately shot her in the head for running away from him. A child would later say in an interview, quote, he was shooting. He shot my father's dog first, and then he shot my father in the foot. He then dragged my mother by her hair. My mother was screaming, and he held a gun to her. And my father said, leave her alone, and he shot him right there.
Yeah, there's no words.
No words. So another victim was a teenage boy named Rafullah. He was either 13 or 14. He was shot in both of his thighs, but thankfully he only ended up being wounded. Another victim was Parmina. She was a slightly older teenager, and this intruder shot her in the chest and the groin. Sadiqwala, a boy who was about 10 years old, took a bullet through his ear, and it brazed his skull, like barely got his skull. This boy later said, quote, the bullet hit my ear, and he was kind of like describing how his ear was, and it kind of like scraped him. And he said, when my father came out, he shot my father. Then he entered our room. We ran from that room to the other room. He came and shot us in that room, and then he left. Zardana, a 7-year-old girl, was shot in the back of the head. 7 years old. The gunman was convinced that these innocent civilians were hiding Taliban, and he was angry at the men that owned the homes for putting their families in harm's way like that. He blamed them, and he took it out on the women and children.
I was about to say, if you're blaming the men, then round up the men and talk to them about it.
Exactly. Don't shoot anything that comes in your way. This man was named Robert Bales. So Robert Bales was born on June 30th, 1973. He was the youngest of 5 boys. He grew up in Norwood, Ohio, which is like 15 minutes north of Cincinnati. Growing up, he was very outgoing, he was friendly, and he was your typical high school popular jock. Just to kind of give you an idea, he was the leader on the football team. So nothing out of the ordinary growing up. In his early 20s, he went to college for a few years, but he never ended up getting a degree, which like a lot of people drop out, so that's no big deal. But instead of like just giving up and saying, screw the world, he actually went and he got his stockbroker's license, which like you can make bank off of that. You can be like Wolf of Wall Street.
Yeah, you sure? I just watched that like a week ago.
Oh, did you really? Mm-hmm. I need to rewatch that. That's so such a good movie. He started his stockbroker business in his hometown, so of that Norwood, Ohio. But I mean, like, if you really want to make the big bucks, you got to go where the big bucks are.
I agree.
Mm-hmm. So he moved to South Florida, and I'm guessing he moved...
South Florida?
Yeah.
That's the big bucks?
Well, like Miami.
Well, there are a lot of, like, rich people out there, yeah, so
like,
I get that.
Like South Beach, Miami.
Yeah.
I'm guessing that area, because that's the only thing I can think of, because it's a lot of old people out there. But he was pretty good at what he did, which I suck at Robin Hood, so please teach me your ways. But he was thriving. He was trading stocks at small community banks. So he wasn't like Wolf of Wall Street or anything like that, but he was pretty good. Until he lost all of his clients' money, his family's money, and even his own.
I wonder on what stock.
So apparently he invested in like a Virginia bank, and the bank went under. Mm. Mm-hmm. So he put all of his eggs in one basket.
Don't do that.
You can't do that. So one investor actually sued him and his firm and won an arbitration agreement of $1.4 million, but never managed to collect it.
Because, oh, I'm sure. Collecting's the hardest part of that stuff.
Yeah, because, I mean, he just didn't have the money. Where are you going to get the money from? Thin air?
You can't.
You can't. So by this time, we're in the 2000s, and now on September 11th, 2001, specifically.
Wow.
And we all know that day, a brutal attack happened on America. At this point in his life, Robert was at a low, and then this happened to the country, and he felt angry, like a lot of us did, and he decided to actually join the military and fight for this country. His brother-in-law would later state, quote, it wasn't like he wanted to fight, it was just, that's what Americans do. You go and get in line with everybody else. You say, we're here to make sure that this doesn't happen again. That's Bob. So he was like a patriotic person.
Right. And a lot of people were back then. Still, oh, yeah, are.
For sure, for sure. And like, he went all in and he didn't want to mess around. And by not messing around, he became a very important position. He became a sniper.
That is a very important position. Very a lot of stress.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. A lot of responsibility. So Bales got stationed near Tacoma, Washington, and he was eager for deployment. He was focused. Like I said, he's intense, but he adjusted to the army life sometimes in darker ways. A lot of it was fueled by alcohol. So just one example, on a night in July of 2002, he was partying at a Tacoma casino and he was arrested for assaulting a security guard. So like, he's one of those people that
he goes hard.
Yeah. And he's an angry drunk. But the bar scene would actually introduce him to his future wife, Carrie. She knew he was in the army and he would be deployed soon, but apparently they had undeniable chemistry and she couldn't let that go. So he did ended up getting shipped off to Iraq. But before he leaves, he was sharing his excitement with her like a little kid. He's saying, yeah, I'm going to go make life great again. I'm going to learn how to wage this war and I'm going to learn all about it.
Or you can just follow your superior's orders, but...
I agree.
Yeah.
So he finally returns after months and months, and he's greeted by Carrie at the airport, and she's so excited to see him. She's showering him with hugs and kisses, but immediately she could tell that he was a different person. He was cold. He didn't want to talk about anything about the war and not what he experienced. So regardless, the first thing that the couple did together was go to a Seahawks game to kind of like rekindle their vibe, had a fun night out. And 5 months later, like, they officially tied the knot. They were married because they were just boyfriend and girlfriend.
Right.
At that time. Just a weird fact, he drank a lot of sugar-free Red Bull, like 6 per day, which I'm surprised he didn't have a heart attack.
I was about to say, like, you can't do that. Like,
no, there was a girl I used to work with, and she literally used to like drink all these Red Bulls a day, and she would get them from behind the bar. And I would say, girl, you got to stop. Like, your heart's literally going to explode. I'm going to be responsible.
Yeah. When we used to teach marching band, we told the kids they couldn't drink energy drinks.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
And that's good because they're so bad for you.
Yeah.
They're
good for your heart. Goes insane.
Yeah. They're good for your energy, obviously. But
Red Bull gives you wings.
It does.
You didn't know that?
Wings to heaven after it gives you a heart attack.
Right.
Dang. So he was also showing signs of paranoia, and Carrie didn't fully perceive it yet. She had a habit of waking him up from nightmares. He was fearful that someone was in his house. So when this happened, he would get out of bed and like look around the house and make sure it was clear. And she kind of thought like nothing of it. And she was saying, oh, that's just part of loving a soldier. He's just taking care of his family.
I see that too. PTSD is a thing. So I would assume the same exact thing as her.
100%, 100%. But I don't think she connected the PTSD to that.
Right.
She was just saying like, oh, he's loving.
Oh, like, got it. Okay.
But yeah, so boozing was also, again, a problem for him, which... yes, a majority of people do drink, but we're usually not powered by anger or whatever it is. It's usually just kind of like relaxing and cutting loose. So now we're going to travel back to spring of 2012, and we're about 10 years down the road. And Robert is now 38 years old, and he's kind of let himself go a little bit. He's 210 pounds, and his hairline is thinning, which I know you can't control that, but he's still in the military at this point. So since he's been in the military for so long, he's risen to the rank of staff sergeant, and he has 19 men under his supervision. And just out of my own sheer curiosity, I looked up the difference between staff sergeant and sergeant. So just as a little fun fact, basically a staff sergeant is a step below the sergeant.
I did not know that.
Yeah. So the staff sergeant is basically like the front of house manager, like if we're talking like restaurant terms. And then the sergeant is like the GM. So he's in charge of the other managers.
Makes sense.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, the war is still going on in Afghanistan, and it's really the dawn of fighting season at this point. So there is an area called Panjwai, which is in the district of Kandahar. This location is the spiritual seat of the Taliban and really one of the most hostile places on the planet. This is where Robert was deployed to the heart of this violent location. The military base was 25 miles southwest of the city of Kandahar. And there are two villages between the base and Kandahar. the villages of Alakozai and Nahabian. So like I said, he is a staff sergeant, and he's thrilled that he has a whole troop to lead. But he had a growing, gnawing gut feeling on the inside of him that his men were still insufficiently prepared, that his superiors were being too passive towards the enemy, and although he was a staff sergeant, he wanted more. He basically wanted to be like King Military and felt like he wasn't getting the respect he deserved. So now let's talk about what an IED is before I tell you the next part of the story. Do you know what it is, or have you ever heard of it?
I have no idea.
So an IED stands for an improvised explosive device. So it's basically a homemade bomb. And I think, to give you like context, it was the bomb made in the Boston Marathon.
Yeah.
On March 5th, 2012, Robert was watching an Afghan man from the roof of his base, he is a sniper after all, walking up and down the rows of a grape field. And in that area, it was hard to distinguish the Taliban from grape farmers, who were innocent bystanders. So Taliban wanted to attack, obviously, and then there you have innocent civilians.
Just doing their job, yeah.
Exactly. But making this distinction was one of his roles, so that they wouldn't harm innocent people. The man had a shovel with him, and he was digging little holes while talking on a cell phone or an ICOM radio, but he never stopped talking on it. And just so you know, an ICOM radio is like a detonator. Basically, it's like, you know, what you see in cartoons. It's a remote with a button on it, and you can talk into it, and it basically like sets off the bomb.
Right.
And like I had said earlier, this was a dangerous area. Minutes before he was watching this man, an IED, a separate IED, had actually flipped a truck of 5 American soldiers. So there's already plenty of chaos in the area. Everybody's trying to figure out what's going on. So Bales is suspicious. Why would this guy be taking care of these specific vines so close to the chaos? So the man was 400 yards away from the site in closing, and he was still holding the device. Then he gets to 350 yards, 300 yards, and Bales is like, fuck, like, what do I do? So the decision Robert had to make was whether to shoot or not, and it would be much easier if he could see, like, the device that he was carrying.
Right.
And the rules of engagement allowed U.S. soldiers to take out any suspected terrorist holding an ICOM radio. But the guy was too far away, and he couldn't tell what it was. So he was like, I don't want to kill an innocent civilian. I'm not going to shoot. Minutes later, there was a soldier from his troop, and he was kind of like clearing up the mess of the previous IED. And he stepped over a wall near a tall dead tree, and then there was an explosion. And this blast took off Ashbury's left lane, and it cleanly cut him at the knee. So it was a bomb that this guy was walking around. Robert felt devastated. He felt that if he would have shot the suspicious grape farmer, he could have saved his leg. Him and other soldiers went to clean up the wreckage and to see if there were any salvageable parts from the previous vehicle attack. And there was a 30-foot dead tree in the middle of the field, like I had said. He saw the tree as a threat because people could hide behind it. That's how, you know, that's where I think the bomb was hiding.
Right.
So over the next few days, like, Robert took this personally. So he tries to, like, chainsaw it down, but the blade was too dull. And then he tried to literally blow it up, and it worked for the most part, but there were still significant portions of the tree left. So finally, on the last day, Bales took an axe and by hand and chopped it down, and it took 8 hours for him. But his adrenaline was so high, and he was so angry at himself. He said, quote, this tree was used to hurt my friends, man. It was used by the enemy. I had to see it go, you know? The tree massacre occurred on March 9th. And like I said, it took 3 days to destroy the tree. But on the third day, the actual massacre occurred. But before that, Robert joined some of his fellow soldiers in a room where they were drinking Jack and Diets. But since alcohol was prohibited on the army base, they put in Dasani water bottles, and if they were to get caught, they would just say it would be Diet Coke.
Right.
Which I'm like, I feel like you would smell.
Oh, for
the
sure.
The whiskey.
The
like
Jack.
Yeah.
Jack has a very distinct smell.
Exactly. So Robert had 6 or 7 drinks, and he kind of just chilled out, and he's watching a movie called Man of Fire that has Denzel
Washington.
Have you seen it?
Yeah.
Oh, I have never seen it.
It's a good show.
Is it? I'll have to watch it. and he was drinking and his mind was wandering and he was just getting angry over three things. One, he kept going on and on about his promotion and why he wasn't an actual sergeant, why he was just a staff sergeant. Two, he was going on and on about his buddy Ashbury's leg getting blown off. If he would have just shot that guy, none of this would have happened. He was too careful. And three, apparently he just randomly started complaining about his marriage. He had two small children, and they were in serious financial trouble, and they were fighting constantly. And the jacking diets aren't helping.
No, that just ignites it.
Mm-hmm. So after the movie ended, which was just before midnight, he ended up going back to his room, and he was taking some sleeping pills. And he took a lot of sleeping pills. Honestly, probably too many. But he was in desperate need for sleep, because if you think about it, he really hadn't had any sleep for 3 days because he was trying to get that damn tree down.
Right.
And it's also to note that he was on steroids at this time, too, to get jacked with his buddies.
Because steroids are great for, like, emotional issues and everything like that.
Exactly, yeah. And they're totally accepted by the Army.
Oh, like, for sure. Totally. They encourage it, actually.
Mm-hmm. They actually make you take it out of your pre-assessment before you even go in. But his adrenaline was still too high, and his brain was moving at a million miles per minute. He kept thinking about how someone is outside. They're doing something, and somebody's going to kill us all. He became more paranoid by the second until he couldn't take it anymore. With the booze, the pills, and the steroids coursing through his veins, he decided that he needed to get up and take action. He leaps out of his bed, and he walks into the room of 21-year-old Clayton Blackshear, who was a lower rank than him because, again, Robert was 38 at this time. So he's literally 17 years older than this kid. And he goes into this room and he wakes the kid up and he's going on a drunken rant about how their special forces guys aren't aggressive enough. And that's why the Taliban had the confidence to plant a bomb and take out his buddy's leg. And he said, quote, "The Taliban are out there right fucking now, sending signals through the darkness saying, fuck you. And we're just going to sit back and do nothing." And, you know, it's past 12 a.m. at this point, and Clayton was literally half awake when Robert busted in his room. So he basically tells Robert, look, I know you're upset, and so am I, but we have these policies and procedures for a reason. We can't just be going out there and shooting everyone and risking our own lives.
Good job, Clayton.
Yeah, and he's 21 years old, and he has more common sense than this guy. To which Robert responds, who cares if I die? My life isn't worth as much as yours. It doesn't matter if I step on an IED. I'm 38. I've lived a life, and if I get blown up, it's so much less tragic than some 21-year-old kid with all that promise ahead of him. Still, Clayton is like, God damn it, I just want to go back to bed. This drunk idiot needs to get the fuck out of my room. So Clayton basically just tells Robert, like, go back to bed, stay in your lane, we'll talk about this in the morning. So Robert, although frustrated, does just that. He goes back to bed, but again, everything's still coursing throughout his system, like the steroids, the booze, so it was no use. He couldn't go back to bed. He's thinking, I got to see what it is, man. I can't not do anything. Have somebody else get killed or have something else get blown up? Knowing this is out there going on and doing nothing, how can I do nothing? How many times have I done nothing? So he grabs a 9mm pistol and an M4 rifle. He looked around at the Afghan guards who were supposed to be patrolling the area at that time, and quite honestly, it looked like they were asleep, so he just walks out.
Right.
He knew precisely where he was going, to the village of Alakozai. Earlier, apparently, some SEALs had seen Taliban enter the home of two village elders, Syed Jan and Muhammad Naeem, and it took about 20 minutes by foot to get to this village. So this is where the first massacre occurred that I mentioned at the beginning of the story. One of the child survivors stated, quote, I was awake and afraid. I pretended I was asleep and I hid under my blanket. First, he stepped on me. Then he tripped over my brother. He pulled my father off of his bed, brought him to the room. My mother followed, and then he shot my father. A child saying that.
Yeah.
I can't even imagine. So he actually walks, after the massacre, he walks all the way back to the military base. And he sits there for an entire hour at his home base. And then he's like, I'm going to go to the other village, Nahabayin, at 2:30 in the morning. So what he did for that hour that he was sitting there, where he could have gone back to sleep, where he could have turned himself in.
He didn't. He decided to go.
He decided to go kill more people after he already knew what he did. So he was spotted by a guard leaving the camp this time. But the guard did not stop him. Instead, he called Foreign Affairs, warning them that an American who had no business leaving the base had, in fact, left the base. And this time, he was with his M4 gun again, and he was with his helmet and a bulletproof vest. He walked into local farmer's house, Mohammed Dewand. He found his entire family asleep in one room. Robert dragged Mohammed out of bed, and then he screams at half-asleep Mohammed, "Talib, where's the Talib?" To which this guy is terrified, and he's crying, and he's yelling back, "No Talib, no Talib." So Robert shot Mohammed in the head. His wife saw. She was only a few feet away. Then he grabs the wife by his hair, and he grabbed the kid, and trigger warning for child violence. He shoved a pistol in the kid's mouth, and he asked the child, "Where's the Talib?" And Robert denies this to this day, but obviously he's a piece of shit, so I believe witnesses over him.
Right.
He then went to the house of Muhammad Wazir. Now, Muhammad wasn't actually home at this hour, so I'm not sure if he was like a farmer and he was like working late or early or whatever you want to call it on the farm, but his entire family was in the house. The family was sleeping together in one room, huddled together for warmth. It got cold at night. And this boy named Isa had actually already been woken up by gunfire and heard him come in the house. So he was pretending to be asleep. And then as soon as like he was able to, he got up and grabbed a shovel and hit Bales over the head.
Good.
Which, badass little boy.
Yeah, great.
Yeah. But unfortunately, he easily overpowered the little boy and he beat him. He also beat several other family members so that he left hair and skin stuffed to the wall. Like, that's how bad he beat him.
Oh my gosh.
He shot all of them. Muhammad would later state, "I was not at home. At the break of dawn, I received calls. They told me my whole family had been killed. They said the Americans did it." This monster then took linen and blankets from the cupboard and put them on top of the bodies. He poured kerosene from a lantern nearby on top of the bodies and set the room on fire. He still says, at this point in time, he says, "I was still looking for homemade explosives," which none of them were found that night.
Well, yeah, because they weren't there.
No, because they were innocent civilians just trying to sleep. Robert came into contact with one more poor woman that night, an elderly woman named Shah Tarina, who was Muhammad Wazir's mother. He did not have any more ammo, so he beat her to a pulp until she was dead. And then, like a piece of firewood, he put her on top of the fire that he had already started. So Muhammad's wife, nephew, and other relatives, 11 total, were shot point blank by him. So all in all, the night of the massacre, Robert killed 4 men, 4 women, and 8 children, the youngest child being 2 years old.
I don't understand how someone does that.
I just can't imagine not shooting anyone, but especially shooting a child.
Yeah.
I can't imagine that. So Robert said, quote, "At this time, now I think it hit me. I think there's a point that, you know, when it hits you, what you did, this is it. Everything you worked for, everything you ever loved is now in a matter of hours destroyed. So I sat in the room, put the gun in my mouth. I just couldn't do it, man. It came down to thinking about my kids. I couldn't do it. I sat there. I don't know how long it was, but I got up. I walked outside. All night I was in a t-shirt and just a pair of army pants. And now I'm just freezing. Before, I wasn't cold at all. Now I'm freezing. They use blankets to cover doors, so I cut a blanket off the door and used it to cover up. I remember being disoriented when I came out. But at this point, they're shooting up flares from the VSP. That's how I knew where I was, the flares." So he's saying that he didn't kill himself because of his children after he just shot 8 children.
Yeah.
But he was right. They had been notified that the American was gone because of the guard and that he was shooting in the villages and that they needed to find him. So the base sent out all these high-tech balloons with thermal cameras, but they only ended up finding him because he actually walked back into the gate at 4:30 a.m. And Also, his walk back was apparently methodical and confident, like a man who had just walked back from accomplishing a mission.
Which he accomplished nothing that he was trying to do.
Exactly. He didn't find any explosive device. He just killed a bunch of innocent people. So immediately they arrest him, and for the next 8 hours, he half-heartedly confessed to what he did. But finally, he breaks and he says, "I thought I was doing the right thing. I'm sorry I let you guys down. My count is 20. You will thank me come June. We shouldn't have to worry about collateral consequences." And apparently June is like the height of fighting season in the war.
Okay.
But he didn't even know how many people he killed. He said, "My count is 20. So either he didn't know how many people he killed because he lost count, or he thought that the wounded were dead. So not long after, he was taken out of Afghanistan. And the Afghanistan president and citizens were rightfully angry. They wanted him tried in Afghanistan.
And he should have been.
He should have been. And they wanted him hanged for his crimes. And you know I love a good defense lawyer's argument. Mm-hmm. So they said that we can blame Bales for what he did, and we should, but not without assigning a share of the blame to our government and ourselves for allowing it to happen. He had PTSD. He had disassociation. He had an out-of-body experience. Which, a whole massacre for that? That's a lot.
Yeah.
So his defense lawyer proposed a deal. Take the death penalty off the table and he will plead guilty. And they agreed to that.
I think that's fair.
And he agreed. In June of 2013, Bales pleaded guilty to a slew of charges, including 16 counts of murder and 6 counts of attempted murder. On August 23rd, 2013, Robert received a life sentence. The jury took less than 90 minutes to decide that he would not get a chance at parole.
Good.
And he actually asked if he could have an opportunity for parole after 40 years, and it was denied, as it should be. He was sentenced to Leavenworth Prison, which is right outside of Kansas City, Kansas. He is working on getting his college degree and working in the prison barbershop, which I don't really understand the college degree part of it.
I mean, it's just something to do while you're in there.
That's what I figured. Like, you're just bored. What else do you have to do? However, he is working with the Combat Clemency Project, which is a team in Chicago that reconsiders the sentence of American soldiers who were convicted of murders committed while they were deployed in Iraq or Afghanistan. And it's actually gotten 6 people out so far.
Hopefully not him, though. Hopefully it's like people that didn't massacre a village.
Exactly. And I think that's a very distinct difference. Like, he literally murdered 16 people for no reason. And I feel like this project is more focused towards, like, I didn't know if that was the Taliban or a grape farmer.
Right.
So I don't think, I hope he won't get out. He shouldn't. But he said, quote, "You wake up one morning and you're like, wow, I'm an incredibly terrible human being." And I agree with him. The army gave Muhammad Wazir, the guy that lost 11 family members that night, $50,000 for each member and $10,000 for each wounded. Which, even though that's a nice gesture, he said he didn't want money. He wanted him back in Afghanistan and he wanted him dead.
Right.
Like all of his other family members. So an innocent survivor of one of the villages said, quote, "The Americans, the occupants of our country say, we bring you reconstruction and progress. They brought no development, just destruction." Robert apologized to his fellow soldiers and he wrote like this long apology letter, but I think he's full of shit, so I'm not going to read the apology. But really the question is, why? Why did he do this? He says he was not in his right state of mind. He says, "Was I in some kind of trance? I'm still baffled by it," which is the number one excuse.
Everyone always says, "I woke up and there was just blood on my hands. I had no idea.
I blacked out. How did this happen? How did I get here?" So an author from a really great article I read thinks it's because, I mean, he was crumbling. He was losing his finances. He wasn't getting promoted in his career. His body wasn't what it used to be. And his mind, like, he had a lot of paranoia. He felt marginalized and disdained by elite soldiers. He did not feel loved. He did not feel like a man. And he wanted to prove his mettle as a soldier one last time, even if it cost him his life. The Kandahar massacre is the deadliest war crime attributed to a single American soldier since 9/11, which is very ironic because that's the reason he joined the military in the first place.
Right.
And this is just kind of a fun fact. No U.S. military member has been executed in the United States since 1961. But that is the story of Robert Bales, the person behind the Kandahar massacre.
I've never heard of that. So thank you for sharing. That was actually really interesting.
Yeah, it was very interesting. It was interesting to do more of like, you know, a lot of people murdered at once versus like over time. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's just crazy. It made me very angry. It made me sweat a lot.
Yeah.
So it's just a bad story, but he most likely will be in prison for the rest of his life.
And I hope he is.
I hope so too. So, all right.
Well, good. Well, if you guys have any questions, comments, or anything, please message us.
Case suggestions. You just want to say hi.
Tag us in your story. We're here. We're on Instagram at
Colts, Killers, and Cocktails. It's a very simple handle. And we will be back soon because we're not going to leave you stranded for Jen's part two.
So. Yeah.
All right. See you later.
Bye.
Bye.